You're listening to TIP.
I don't know where I'm going half the time, but I'm excited and confident about it. It generally works out.
On today's show, I talk with a guy that needs no introduction, and that's Brandon Turner. We chat about his backstory on how he got started at BiggerPockets, what the stack is, how to use real estate as a college fund, the importance of focus, why he defaults to saying no to building new bridges until another one hits shore, what continual improvement is and how elite performers use it, and we talk about a bunch more. Brandon Turner is a real estate investor, podcaster, author, entrepreneur, and speaker. As the host of the BiggerPockets podcast with over 100 million downloads, Brandon is widely recognized as one of the foremost experts on real estate investing. Brandon is also the founder and managing member of Open Door Capital. I have learned a ton from Brandon himself, his content, and his books over the years, so it was great to finally sit down and chat with him. I hope you guys enjoy this conversation as much as I did. Let's dive in.
You're listening to Real Estate Investing by the Investors Podcast Network, where your host, Robert Leonard, interviews successful investors from various real estate investing niches to help educate you on your real estate investing journey.
Hey everyone, welcome back to the Real Estate 101 podcast. As always, I'm your host, Robert Leonard, and with me today, I have a special guest, Brandon Turner. Brandon, welcome to the show.
What's up, man? Robert, it's awesome to be here. Thank you for inviting me in.
I've had quite a few people in your circle on the show, Ryan, Tristan, a couple others, Scott, Mindy. First time you and I have been able to connect, though. I'm looking forward to it.
Well, this is going to be a disappointment because those are some rock stars. So I'll see if I can live up to how good they are.
A lot of people are familiar with you, but for those who aren't, give us a quick rundown on your background, who you are, what you do.
Yeah, so I got into real estate when I was 21-ish. I think it was like late 20s, early 21. I bought this house and with no really plans other than that it was cheaper to buy than rent. And so I bought this little house, almost no money down. It was like an FHA loan, basically. And this is back in 07. And I like rented out the bedrooms and I was like, this is awesome. Like I'm living for free. And then I sold the house and I made 20 grand. And I was like, this is really awesome. And then I was homeless because I sold my house. And so I bought myself a duplex and I lived in half of that and rented the other half out and my new wife. And man, from there, we just started collecting units. I realized like I could go to law school, which was the plan, or I could just collect a bunch of rental units and eventually not have to work anymore. And so that's what I did. I just kept buying properties and most of that was in Western Washington. I ended up with 30 or 40 of them. And then I bought kind of maintained around that 30, 40 mark for a number of years while I kind of built the BiggerPockets podcast, started teaching the stuff online and then bought a mobile home park at one point, which got me up to almost 100 units. And then I was like, these mobile home parks are awesome. And then bought a couple thousand units of mobile home parks over the last few years. And now I think I just crossed the 3,000 unit mark with both mobile home parks and apartment complexes. So yeah, it's been a wild ride.
I think a lot of people know you and your story from most recent, some of the bigger deals you've been doing, some of the mobile home park stuff, but I don't think a lot of people know more of your backstory, how you got started. So I want to spend a little bit of time talking about that. I think that'll be super relevant for the audience. We'll talk about some of the stuff you're doing now. When you got out of that first house, you were house hacking. I don't think it was coined at the time, right? House hacking wasn't a thing yet.
No, I was just like, I mean, I don't even think I even logically thought through I could live for free. I just remember thinking like, this is a cheap duplex and, you know, maybe the other unit can offset some of the cost. I never even did the math. I didn't know how to do the math. You know, I just was like, well, it'll rent for something and my mortgage is going to be something. So my mortgage will then be less out of my own pocket. Like that was my only thought. I'd never heard anybody talk about it.
So real estate seemed cool, but I mean, there's a million different things you could do. Why did you stick with real estate?
There's this thing, like certain things just like appeal to people, right? Like, I mean, I know guys right now that are like super into like, I don't know, cryptocurrency or shorting AMC or whatever, like the Reddit guys are all doing right now, or yeah, cryptocurrency or the whatever. There's like a million things that appeal to people. Some people are just really big into option trading. Some people are really big into whatever, buying companies or franchising. Like for whatever reason, for a lot of people, when they just think about real estate, it just it creates this like fire in them. Like I get it. I understand it. Like I like to think like real estate's so simple, like a simpleton like me can understand it. And therefore I get excited about it. I'm like, oh, this makes sense. Buy property and every unit you buy makes a little bit of money. And so if you buy a bunch of them, you make a whole lot of money. And that just makes sense to me. And it just fired me up. I once heard, I think it was Warren Buffett once said, like I could have been good at something that didn't like being a teacher. I could have been fired up about being a teacher or being a fireman, but I wasn't. I was fired up about making money. So why? I have no idea, but something in me just fires me up about the idea of making money through real estate.
You actually mentioned something there that I didn't plan on talking about, but it's actually something I've wanted to discuss for a while. And you mentioned how each house provides a little bit of money. So if you get a lot of them, it makes a lot of money. What do you say to those people who are like, real estate sounds great, I understand it, but it's only $200 a month. Like, that's nothing, right? I got to put out $15,000, $20,000 to get $200, $250 a month. Why would I ever do that?
Yeah, it's a great question. Because yeah, if you're just going to make, when you start investing in real estate, yeah, your first house is probably $100 to $200 a month. Maybe if you buy a big expensive house, maybe you're making more than that. But most people in the blue collar areas buying a couple $100,000 property, you're probably making $200 a month. You might be getting a 10% on your money, which is probably comparable to the stock market, maybe a little better than the stock market. But it's like, why do that? That's the question. Why go invest in stuff for that little bit of money? The way I like to look at it is those little deals are kind of the equivalent of like if you go and put in $50 in the stock market. It's irrelevant to your future, right? Throwing $50 in the stock market or buying a piece of Bitcoin is fairly irrelevant, most likely. But what it does is it gets you in the game. And real estate investing is a very scalable business. It's a very scalable investment. And it's a scalable investment that can utilize other people's money to scale it. So in other words, that $100 a month, $200 a month, it's fairly useless. So you buy a house. Okay, great. You're $200 a month. Then you buy a duplex maybe next year. Now you're making like $400 a month. Well, still pretty useless. So, you know, whatever. It's a few hundred dollars a month for spending money for your gas and your gas tank, but it's whatever. But then you go buy a 5-unit property. And then you're like, okay, well, now I'm making a little bit. And then after that, you buy a 20-unit property. And then after that, you buy a 50-unit property. And now all of a sudden, in one purchase, you get a 50-unit property. And all of a sudden, like, boom, like you're retired. I mean, like, it really scales fast. The reason why is because, like, real estate is exponential growth versus like linear growth, right? Like, linear growth would be like, I have $10 and now I have $20 and now I have $30 and now I have $40. But real estate can be exponential. I have one unit, now I have two, now I have five, now I have 10, now I have 30, now I have 50. It ramps up so quickly. And at every level of that, you're gaining knowledge and skills and contacts in the industry and confidence and excitement. And you're making some money along the way that you can then recycle into new deals. And so, yeah, that's where, like, in the beginning, yeah, it's worthless. Those first deals don't matter at all, but they matter so much because you can't get to the later deals, or it's really hard to get to the big deals until you've gone through the little ones. And that's how I look at the smaller deals, is they're just training ground.
And I remember on a podcast, this was a while ago now, but you and David, one of you had said, I pretty much know nobody that has only done one real estate deal. Once you do one deal, you've done at least two or three or four. You know, you don't know pretty much anybody that's only done one deal.
Yeah. Well, it's like I was once at a Costco and I ran into this guy who was from the island here. I live in Maui. So this guy in Maui, he's like, hey, aren't you, Brandon from the podcast? I was like, yeah. And he's like, hey, cool. Nice to meet you. He goes, I heard you were doing jujitsu now. And I said, yeah, actually, I just started. Well, he goes, what belt are you? And I said, oh, I just started. I'm a white belt. I said, I'm only a white belt. And he said, well, Brandon, don't just say only a white belt, because the white belt is the hardest belt. Now, for those that aren't familiar with martial arts, like, the white belt's the belt they give you when you show up. It's like your first belt. Like, it's an automatic, you get the belt. It's just, it means nothing. Why would he say the white belt is the hardest belt? It's because most people in the world don't get the white belt. Most people never step foot in the gym. And so that's why, like, once you buy one property, you're now in the gym. You've got the white belt. And people don't typically stay the white belt. I mean, they move up and they eventually move into other belts because, I mean, not all of them, obviously. Many people do fall away. But in real estate, especially, like, you buy the one, you're in. You're in and you realize it. It's like proof. Oh, this actually works. Or, wow, I really screwed that one up. I'm going to do better next time. And so nobody buys one deal. If they have the guts and the boldness and the fortitude and the persistence to get the one deal, they have what it takes to get 50 of them. And yeah, they're going to make it.
Today, I would say that you and Bigger Pockets kind of go together like peanut butter and jelly. But similar to your real estate backstory, I don't think a lot of people know how you got started at Bigger Pockets. Tell us how you got started there.
Yeah, so it actually started with, so I'm 27 years old and I had quit my job. I worked at a bank as like a banker. I opened checking accounts for people and all that. And I was building my real estate portfolio during that. And I bought an apartment complex. It was a 24-unit apartment building. I fixed it up myself. I did all the work pretty much. I'd go in there and fix up each unit one at a time. My wife and I together would go and paint till 3 a.m, get the unit rented out, and then move on to the next one. And over the course of several years, from 24 when we bought it to 27 when I was like stabilized, we just fixed it up. And then I'm like, all right, okay, now I'm 27 years old. I got about $3,000 to $4,000 in profit coming in every month. We call that cash flow, just extra money. And I'm like, well, what do I do now with my life? I was like, I guess I'm retired. Quit my bank job. And I just sat at home for a few months. And I was like, well, this is boring. So I decided, I was like, well, I'd like to make more money than what I have now. And now I don't have a job. I can't get loans anymore. Maybe I'll get into internet marketing, which is like, I was like, could I like sell products on Amazon or eBay? And I started researching that. And I started researching other stuff. And none of it really clicked until I discovered I could write. I'm a halfway decent writer. When I look back, I'm like, no, I was not a halfway decent writer. I was a terrible writer. But I thought I was a halfway decent writer. So I started blogging on this little website I started called Real Estate in Your 20s. It actually still exists today, realestateinyour20s.com. I haven't updated it in a decade, but I started writing there. And the secret to like growing your blog back in the day, and it still kind of is true today, is you go and write for another person's blog. So who was the biggest blog in the real estate space at the time? It was Josh Dorkin, founder of Bigger Pockets, had this blog called the Bigger Pockets blog. So I started writing and guest writing over there. And that became me and Josh then, the founder, became friends. And then one day he's like, he put on his Facebook, hey, I'm looking for someone to help me edit blog posts. Who's good at editing and wants to make some money? I was like, I'll do it. You know, I could use some more money. So I started editing blog posts just for like, I don't even remember what he's paying me, probably like 20 bucks an article or something like that. But I would edit them and then I'd post them. And that's how it started. And a few months into that, I was like, hey, Josh, let's start a podcast. We should make this thing a podcast. And that's where the Bigger Pockets podcast came from.
Did you guys have grand ambitions for Bigger Pockets to be what it is today? Or was it kind of just flying blind?
Yeah, no, I had no, like I had gotten into internet marketing right like that year. But even before that, I didn't know anything about what I was doing. I didn't even have a computer a year before joining Bigger Pockets. Like I had no idea and no expectations. I remember us talking, we said our goal is within, I think I said within 2 years, we want to be the top 100 business podcast. We want to be in the top 100 of all business podcasts. And the day we launched, we hit like number 6 and then never dropped below 20 ever. Now today we're typically right around 6 or 7 of business podcasts. And so that was a shock, a huge shock. Because again, like it's just like within 2 years, we want to be in the top 100. Yeah, no, didn't expect that. There were a few other websites at the time that were all kind of equal to Josh. Like there's Bigger Pockets and there's one called CRE Online and one called REI Club. They're still around, I think. And Josh, or you know, Bigger Pockets and REI Club and CRE were kind of the same size. Neither of them had like a big solid, like, you know, footing. And then when I came on board at Bigger Pockets, and I'll preface this by saying like, it wasn't me that did this, but I'll tie this into a lesson here in a second. When I came on board at Bigger Pockets, all of a sudden we just took off. And I think the podcast was a huge driver of that. But to the point where Bigger Pockets became the dominant player, like the category king, they call it, in the real estate education space. And again, it's not that suddenly I came and knew what I was doing. In fact, I was a terrible writer. I didn't know how to edit, didn't know how to spell or do grammar. It was the fact that for the first time, like Josh as visionary had somebody to be the integrator. Now, for those who aren't familiar with the term, it comes from a book called Traction, where it says every great company has two key roles at the top. There's a visionary, somebody who sees where we're headed and lays out the plan and motivates everyone to get there, usually the CEO, and then somebody else to be the one that drives the actual like tasks forward. Like, because the two are usually not the same person, the visionary and integrator. So I kind of became the integrator. I was the one writing the blog posts and the one editing things and then managing the forums and then starting the podcast, doing the actual like day-to-day annoying work. And because of that, that mixture of the right integrator and the right visionary creates what they call rocket fuel. It's like the right mixture of two chemicals, and it led to explosive growth. So the lesson for everyone here is if you're struggling to get started, especially for a long time, maybe it's because you are a visionary or you are an integrator, but you're probably not both. It's very rare to be both. And so I would recommend thinking hard about who you are. Are you the visionary or the integrator? And if you're the visionary, then get yourself an integrator and watch the rocket fuel just take you off.
Brandon mentioned two books there, Traction and Rocket Fuel. Those are both by Gino Wickman. We've had him here on the podcast. You guys can go back and check out that episode. Why did Josh hire you? If your editing skills sucked, your writing skills sucked, why did he hire you?
I'm a good interview. I think I made Josh believe. Like I'm pretty good at like selling my points. You know, like even today, like I could argue pretty well why crypto is such an amazing thing. And I don't know anything about crypto, but I'm pretty good at like getting people jazzed up and excited about it because I get excited about it. Even stuff I don't know about, I can get myself pretty pumped up and excited. So in talking with Josh, it started with just like, dude, I could write like 100 blog posts. Like I think that's what I told him. I'll write like 100 blog posts in the first year. So I wrote 100 blog posts for different companies in the first year that all pointed back to Bigger Pockets, which led to a lot of have SEO growth, you know, by people visiting the site. So yeah, and there's a great book out there called Big Money Energy, I think is what it's called, by Ryan Serhant. He's the guy from like Million Dollar Agent or Million Dollar Listing or something like that. But his whole point is like so much success in life is just about being confident and having that energy, like that big money energy, like, yeah, I got this. We can do this. We're going to the moon. And everyone's like, yeah, follow that guy. He knows where he's going. And I don't know where I'm going half the time, but I'm excited and confident about it. It generally works out.
I don't want this to be a knock on BP if you say no, but do you think you'd be where you are today if it wasn't for BiggerPockets?
Yeah, no, not a chance. And here's why. I am not somebody who is good at sticking with things for the long term. When I talk to people about Josh Dorkin, who founded BiggerPockets, I like to say that Josh is the best entrepreneur I've ever met. Not because he's wicked smart, which he is. He's crazy smart. And not because he's, you know, a hard worker, which he is. He's the best entrepreneur I know because he stuck with something for years and years and years without it making money. BiggerPockets had existed for almost a decade before I came in. He had worked at it like by himself every day, no employees, no help, just making no money for year after year after year, trying to improve it, trying to make it work, where 99.999% of the population would have given up. And that's why Josh is so successful today and why BiggerPockets is so successful. So what I mean by that is I would not have continued real estate in your 20s. I really don't believe it. I would have gotten bored after another few months or 6 months to a year. But the thing is, when you're getting a paycheck, when you're making money, like most people tend to stick with things for the long time because they have to, it's their job, right? So BiggerPockets became essentially a job to me that I showed up every day and I worked at. I did not have the mindset of a true entrepreneur. Now, I think that's changed. Now, today I actually run my own real estate company and I've stuck with it for a while. But the key with me even sticking with it is I had to do what Josh did. I had to bring in an integrator because I would not have stuck with Open Door Capital long enough working in the business. I had to get out of working in the business, work on the business. And that's, I think, is the key to long-term sustainability as an entrepreneur. You have to like force yourself to stick with it by allowing other people to obligate you to stick with it. Does that make sense?
Yeah. So you would have quit your website, but would you have kept with real estate?
You know, I think I would have kept with real estate because I'd been in it already for a decade, almost, you know, or 7 years. I think I would have just slowly picked up another property here and there. Because here's the funny thing about real estate, right? You naturally will climb to the level of which your mentors are at. Because that's your, for lack of a better term, like your God, like that's your idol that you're moving toward is the people in your life that are successful towards that. So like, for example, like if you're a basketball player and there's like this like player that you idolize, you're probably going to play like that player. You're going to learn like that player. Same thing is true for real estate. You're going to move towards your mentors. And my mentor had like, you know, 50 units and he did all his own work and he would manage, you know, once in a while he'd hire employees and not employees, but contractors. And they're usually felons right out of prison and they would do a terrible job and he would have to yell at them. And he lived a very stressful landlording life, but that was my model. That's what I knew. And so that's what I was mimicking the first half a decade or decade of my investing. And it wasn't until I got into the BiggerPockets community and we started the podcast, I started interviewing people and meeting people in real life that were at an entirely different level that I was like, oh, there's a whole other way to do this. I want to do it that way. I think that actually sounds fun. Oh, I could be a visionary and not do the work, like all the work. And so, yeah, I think I would have stuck with real estate at a very painful level for a long time.
Let's take a quick break and hear from today's sponsors.
Hey, everyone. It's Patrick, your host of Millennial Investing. Every year, my buddies and I do a guy's trip to escape the cold and dreary Ohio winters. Once we pick our destination, without fail, we all jump on Airbnb and find an incredible place to stay. We just got back from an amazing trip in Palm Springs, California, and our Airbnb home was a huge part of creating memories we'll never forget. I loved it so much, I'm taking my family back to Palm Springs for spring break, and we're staying in an Airbnb home my kids fell in love with and picked out themselves. While I was there, I had the realization that my own home could be an Airbnb. It's an excellent way to earn some extra cash, whether you're saving up for your next vacation, paying off some bills, or investing. Your home might be worth more than you think. Find out how much at airbnb.com/host. That's airbnb.com/host.
Buy low, sell high. It's easy to say, hard to do. For example, high interest rates are crushing the real estate market right now. Demand is dropping and prices are falling, even for many of the best assets. It's no wonder the Fundrise flagship fund plans to go on a buying spree, expanding its billion-dollar real estate portfolio over the next few months. You can add the Fundrise flagship fund to your portfolio in just minutes and with as little as $10 by visiting fundrise.com/millennialinvesting. Carefully consider the investment objectives, risks, charges, and expenses of the Fundrise Flagship Fund before investing. This and other information can be found in the fund's prospectus at fundrise.com/flagship. This is a paid advertisement.
Hey guys, when it comes to financial advice, you've got to trust the source. It's why you listen to this podcast. When I'm looking to upgrade my wallet, I turn to NerdWallet. Their expert team of nerds dives into the details to help you find smarter financial products. Before NerdWallet, I'd pay for vacations with whatever credit card was in my wallet. But I was missing out on miles I didn't even know I was leaving on the table. Now I've got a new card with more miles and more upgrades. What could future you do with more travel rewards? A hotel upgrade? Lounge access? A free flight to a bucket list destination? Wherever you go next, make it happen with a smarter travel credit card. Don't wait to make smart financial decisions. Compare and find smarter credit cards, savings accounts, and much more today at nerdwallet.com. NerdWallet, finance smarter. Check out nerdwallet.com and start making smarter financial decisions. As with all cards, credit is subject to lender approval and terms apply.
All right, back to the show.
What do you think you've learned from the experience of joining Bigger Pockets that new investors can take away from it? Should they also try to get involved with a BP-like company that can help their careers, whether it's real estate or not? And I think this is an interesting question because people who listen to this show are probably fans of our company, TIP, for a while. And at TIP, we joke that I'm the Brandon Turner at TIP because it was started by two guys similar to Josh in your situation. And then I came in kind of early days and helping scale and grow it just like you did with Bigger Pockets. So I've kind of taken a similar path to you, and I'm seeing how it's helping my career and my investing. So I'm curious what we can teach newer investors from kind of what we've done.
That's such a great question. Yeah, I think one of the most important things in life is to do work that you're passionate about and you love doing, like work, like what your day-to-day work. Now that could be real estate. It could be flipping houses or wholesaling or some kind of like real estate, like entrepreneurship type business, which is fine. But it also could be internet marketing. It could be working at a title company. It could be being a real estate agent. I think just doing something day-to-day that has scalable income opportunities, meaning that it's not like somebody pays you $50,000 a year and that's all you can get. Bigger Pockets gave me scalable income opportunities. Specifically through writing books. So when I write books, I get a large percentage, or not a huge percentage, but I get a good percentage of the sales that come in, of the profit. And so therefore, like I invest time into creating significant cash flow from a business that's within another business. They call those intrapreneurs. So being a real estate agent is kind of an entrepreneurship. Even though technically you are self-employed, you're really just an agent for a large brokerage that you work under another agent, or you work for a brokerage company. But that's great. Who cares, right? Like you have a scalable income source. So, you know, if you're making 45 grand a year as a teacher and you're in Ohio, like it's hard to save enough money to go out there and buy a bunch of real estate. So you have a couple options. You could go out there and create a bunch of wealth by being creative, like flipping, like wholesaling, like putting together some no and low money down deals. Nothing wrong with that. Or you can go find a scalable way on the side to make a bunch of income, whether it's working for another company or whatever, and then take all that extra income and dump it in real estate. So today, yeah, like I make money from a number of different sources and I dump almost everything I don't spend into real estate. I just constantly just buy more and more real estate, which also helps offset the taxes, which is nice. So yeah, I'm 100% on board with doing something you love that gives you scalable income.
I want to dive into a few strategies or maybe topics that you've talked about over the years from podcasts, YouTube videos, maybe even social media that I really liked and that I think the audience can learn from. And the first one is when you talked with Josh about focus by Thing to Know. And then you used an analogy about building bridges and not working on other bridges until one hits the shore. Explain to us what this concept is and why it's so important.
Yeah, every investor, every entrepreneur has this that I've ever met, I think has the same fault, and we all do it. It is this idea that we are invincible and we are infinite and we can do an infinite number of projects. And so we tend to say yes to things. We tend to start. So the analogy being every, like you live on one island and you want to get to this like financial freedom island or wealth island or success island, whatever. But in this imaginary world, there are no planes, there are no boats. The only way to get there is to build a bridge. And so you start building this bridge, but and that bridge might be flipping houses. But then you see an infomercial for Bitcoin trading and you're like, oh, that sounds cool too. So you start working on Bitcoin, start learning about that. Then you hear about options. And then you hear about starting an Amazon business and then selling eBay stuff. And you start building all these little bridges. The problem is we have a finite number of hours in the day. And so every day, the more bridges you have to build every day, the slower each bridge gets built. And so essentially no bridge ever gets to the promised land, never gets to them, that fantasy island, because you spent all your time building 20 bridges and each one's just partially constructed. Because at the end of the day, a bridge that's 99% finished is still just a pile of cement and rebar, right? Like the goal, like you have to get all the way there. But here's the beauty. Once you get all the way there, now you can go back and build other bridges. Still, I would try to limit them, but you've already made it once. You already have the wealth and freedom coming in. So I have that through real estate. And so I could go build the other bridge, which at the time, I'll give a real example of it. So I built up my first roughly $3,000 a month in income from real estate. That was my focus. I built it through real estate and just buying these crappy rentals. Now it was hard work and I had to manage them myself and I had to do all my own maintenance and repairs, but it was still, I had made it to that like level one financial freedom. I could pay my bills using the money I made from real estate. So that allowed me to go build another bridge. That bridge was called Bigger Pockets. It allowed me to take a risk. It's similar to if you ever play the game Cash Flow from Robert Kiyosaki, the game is played in this little tiny circle. They call it the rat race, right? You just go round and round and round and round and round and round. It's this little like 6-inch circle. But then once you make enough income in the game, you make more income than you're spending, you get out of the rat race. And now you're in a whole different game where you're doing really cool stuff. You're taking risks that allow for way bigger payoffs. So because I had the $3,000 or $4,000 a month, depending on the month, coming in, I could take a risk on this little site called Bigger Pockets that I had a chance for building a lot of wealth in and a lot of cash flow from. And so I took that chance. And so that bridge ended up panning out. But if I wouldn't have had that $3,000 or $4,000 a month coming in, I don't know if I would have even pursued Bigger Pockets because I don't know if I would have thought it paid enough money. Josh didn't have hardly any money in the beginning to pay me. And so it was kind of like, well, you know, I can pay you a little bit right now. And if you can make me more than that, maybe we'll talk about giving you more later on. Like it was like that kind of arrangement. And I was like, all right, I'm in because I had the ability. So yeah, bridge building. I would say the number one reason people fail, the number one reason above everything else is because they're simply building too many bridges.
So how do we focus on which bridge to build? I literally have right behind me, I have a couple of your books. And I have the one thing, and this is the biggest thing that I struggle with still. I cannot focus on one bridge. I have probably 100 bridges going across from island to island right now, and I really need to focus. And I'm trying to learn, and I think a lot of people in the audience are entrepreneurs and deal with the same thing. So how do we focus on that one bridge?
Yeah, a couple of thoughts come to mind. First of all, knowing what that bridge is, that's the most important bridge. Like what's the priority bridge? What's the thing that is most important that if you dedicate your time towards that, then every day, even every hour, like the task you're working on, is there anything you can first do on the, we'll call it the primary bridge. Is there anything you can do on the primary bridge that anything that actionable that can be done, you should do that above anything else, right? But it's a lot of the times, like the thing that we have to do is like send an email. Let's just say your primary bridge is building a real estate, you know, building $5,000 a month in passive income from your rental properties. Great. If that's the bridge, maybe like you have to send this email, but now you got to wait for that email to come back before you can even move on to the next step of whatever you're trying to buy. Okay, great. So you've done all you can on the primary bridge. Now you can go to the next bridge and go work on that thing if you need to, or go to the beach or something fun. But then go back the next day or even the next hour and say, okay, wait, now, is there anything else I can do on the primary bridge? So it's always keeping that the primary and everything else comes second. So step one again is identifying what is that primary bridge and then asking yourself every day, is there any actionable step I can do towards this primary bridge right now? The third thing you can do is if you want to have multiple bridges, it's actually doable. The answer is to hire other people to build your bridges for you and you become more of a foreman that oversees all the bridges. Now, I still don't love that idea, but if you have to or if it's an important thing, you can find ways for other people to build bridges. Now, maybe that's partnerships. So each person in the partnership is moving the bridge forward, but you only have one little piece of it. So you only got to show up once in a while and pour concrete, but they're doing all the rebar and all the foundation work. So you just show up and do concrete once in a while. Now that bridge is getting built even when you're not actively working on it. Or you could hire employees to build the bridge for you. There's some automation there, but that's pretty tough. But yeah, figuring out what that one thing is, and the one thing is a great book for that. And just constantly reminding yourself is probably the key to that. What do you think?
I don't know. It's literally something I'm struggling with right now so bad is focus because there's just shiny objects everywhere. As entrepreneurs, you've said it's the number one thing that makes people fail. And I completely agree. And I feel like I'm working on, let's just say, 5 different projects right now. And I'm not doing great at any of them because I'm working on all of them. And I feel like if I really just focused on 1 to 2 of them, I think I could do them really well instead of doing all 5.
Yeah. And the other thing to remember is I tell myself this a lot. Not now doesn't mean never, right? So when I get excited about another project, like I really would love to launch like a performance coaching company. I love performance coaching. I've been a huge advocate for years. There's such money to be made there. I could make a killing. I could make millions of dollars off owning some big performance coaching company where I hire a bunch of coaches and we bring in a lot of clients and it helps everybody wins. Win, 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 win across the board. But Open Door Capital, my commercial real estate company that we buy mobile home parks and apartments, is my primary bridge. So I have simply said, rather than the fear of missing out, the FOMO of the performance coaching company, I just have to remind myself, and honestly, I have to remind myself this every day. Not now doesn't mean never. Not now means not now. It means I can do the performance coaching company next year. I mean, how old are you right now?
26.
You're 26. I'm 36, right? I'm like, next year I'll be 37. The year after that, I'll be 38. You'll be 27, 28, right? Like, we have so much time ahead of us. I sound like Gary Vaynerchuk right now, but so much time ahead of us. Like, you could literally work on one thing for the next decade of your life, 10 solid years, which is what I believe most business endeavors require 10 years. Like, it's weird. It's a weird thing. And I don't know why it's that way, but almost everybody successful in business I've ever known has been about 10 years before they got that traction needed to be able to like step back and the thing just takes off. It's about a 10-year process. You could literally spend the next decade of your life on one project, and then the entire next decade on another project, and then the next decade on another, and the next decade on another. And by that time, technology will improve so much that you will all live to 150. So you have like 10 or 12 more of those decades ahead of you that you could do these decade-long projects. And when you think about it in that term, you're like, oh, well, which one of these can be done later? Open Door Capital, I believe we are in a unique position right now to buy apartments and multifamily in America that we will likely never see again. I think this 5 to 10 year period right now is going to be, we're going to look back on this and go, man, remember when real estate used to be cheap in America? Like, if you look at Europe or Australia, real estate is not cheap. It's not. It's super expensive compared to what we pay for it. And so I think we're going to look back on this as a glory year. So right now is the time to do that. Will performance coaching be around 10 years from now? Yes. 5 years from now? Yes. 20 years from now? Yes. So I can do this one now because I don't know if I'll be able to do it later. And so that's another way to kind of decide which bridge to do is which one can be done later. And which one, if I do it, to answer the book, The One Thing, which one that if I do it like right and actually finish that bridge will make the other bridges not that important. It's like, oh yeah, well, I guess if I was making 5 or 10 grand a month off cash flow, off rentals, I wouldn't even have to worry about creating an Amazon business. Oh, well, maybe I should just focus on that. And then the last thing I'll say, and then I'll throw it back to you, is some bridges are really sexy because they sound fun and they sound like a way to make a lot of money. For example, an Amazon business or some kind of e-course or something like that. But some bridges are way more sturdy than others, right? So some bridges are made out of solid concrete and their piers go way down deep into the foundation. And other bridges are made of wood or straw. And so when deciding which bridges to build, sometimes it's worth building the more solid one. And I think real estate is probably the most solid bridge you can build like out there. I mean, there's good money in business. Like, you go start a blog, you go start an Amazon business. That's great. You could make some good money, but also you could lose that money immediately and the whole business could just go kaput. But real estate is so tried and true and it lasts forever. Like, it lasts forever. And it's such a solid bridge. So think of that as too, when you're trying to decide which bridge to build, build the solid one first.
I'm glad you mentioned Gary Vee. Because I find myself going back and forth between the two Garys, Gary Keller from The One Thing and Gary Vaynerchuk. Gary Keller and Jay Papasan say The One Thing, right? Do one thing and that's it. And then you listen to Gary Vee and he says, I love juggling 7, 8, 9 balls all at once. He's like, I couldn't do just one thing at once. And he talks about this all the time. And so that's where I'm like, which Gary do I listen to? And to your point about the sturdiness, I completely agree. But then I wonder, what if somebody has the plan of taking the money from that extra business and putting it into real estate? What if real estate is the ultimate goal, but they don't necessarily have the money to scale that to what they want? And so they're going to make the money in another business and then pour that into real estate. Now it's like, which one do I focus on? Because I could scale real estate if I focus on a little bit more, maybe, or I can just go out, start this other business, make some money there, and then pour that into real estate.
Yeah, that's so good. Couple thoughts. First of all, I'm 100% on board for people who are like, you know what? I'm going to use right now. I'm going to build this consulting business because I'm there and I'm ready and I know I can do this and I can make a lot of money as a, you know, whatever. I'm going to start a plumbing business. I'm going to go start a bathroom remodeling company, whatever, because I believe I can make that business so successful and generate so much profit that I can then use to dump into real estate. More importantly, in that conversation with yourself is which one fires you up more? Like, honestly, if you're like, I like real estate, but I really love the idea of building a construction company, I would choose the construction company right now. Because if you're more excited about it and you are honest with yourself that you're going to do the work needed to become the leader needed to be able to build that into an actual business, not just a self-employed job. If you're really willing to do that, yeah, then grow. You're going to have more energy to do that and to build that thing up super successful. And then you can dump the money into passive investments. Go give it to guys like me or guys like you, like give it to other people to go invest. You can be a passive investor because you're doing what fires you up. And you know, you're investing your money in other stuff. Now let me go back to the Gary Vaynerchuk versus Gary Keller thing. I love Gary V, but Gary V and a lot of other online influencers have a tendency, and I probably fall into this as well. We have a tendency to preach what works for us today as if that's what got us to where we're at today, when in reality it isn't. So in other words, yeah, Gary is doing a ton of different things right now. He's doing NFTs and he's doing the VCon, cards, all that stuff, right? But 10 years ago, what was he doing? Wine. That was it. He even brags about this, right? I worked for 15 years in my dad's basement, you know, or at my dad's company, and I lived in my basement and I worked for 10 years. I did nothing but wine. And that's all he did, is he made his dad's store amazing. And then he shifted, he pivoted, and he made Wine Library TV. He did 1,000 videos. That's all he did. He was not doing NFTs back when he was doing Wine Library. He was not building a social media empire when he was doing Wine Library. That's all he was doing. Then he shifted from that after he was making a killing off that, I'm sure. And he could then build a podcast or whatever. Well, I don't know if it was a blog or Daily V came first. I don't remember the order. But then he built the social media thing. Then he started to expand. And as he got wealthier and wealthier and wealthier, he started hiring people to build bridges for him. I guarantee you, Gary did not build a single NFT that he has right now. He did not figure out how to do it. He didn't go do the work. He doesn't even know how they work, probably. Maybe he does. He has people around him that are building his bridges for him. And that's what he should be doing. That's what a great entrepreneur does. They hire a bunch of people to do that. But in the beginning, that is not what he did. He focused head down, built his dad's wine business in-house, and he has excelled from there. And that's why he's successful.
That's a really, really good point. I hadn't given it that consideration. I just hear him speaking and explaining it the way he does today. And I didn't consider what he did actually decades ago when he was building. We also, when we were talking about the bridges, it's something, when you're building a bridge, you got to do it continuously. And I've heard you talk about how continual improvement is the differentiator of the elite. What is continual improvement, and how do elite performers use that everyday people don't?
Every episode of the podcast, every single one, I've done 500 episodes now of the Bigger Pockets podcast. Every single time we end, and the first thing we say is, okay, what can we do better? We don't always use those words, but that's what the conversation is. What can we do better? Every interaction, every book that I write, every time I publish anything, I'm always asking, how do I refine my systems? How do I make this better? How do I make this easier next time? How do I make this sell better? How do I make this real estate transaction go easier? How do I get a better employee? How do I, everything. It's always just continually asking the question, I can do better, how? But most of the world simply takes what they're given and assumes that's the way they're always going to do whatever it is they're doing. It's like, well, yeah, that's just what I always do. So you work at a job, you're a real estate agent. You haven't made any changes in your real estate business life in the last 20 years. You've been the same agent for 20 years. Nothing's changed. So continual improvement is a thing that I see separates successful people from unsuccessful people in such a massive degree, because there's always trying to do better. I mean, this is like David Greens of the world. Like, David is one of the best real estate agents in the world. Why? Because he just continually asks himself, like, what did I do wrong? What's my team screwing up on? How do I do better? And it's not in a negative light. Like, we still celebrate our wins. Like, high achievers still celebrate, maybe not as much as we should, but it's just always refining the process so it gets better and better and better. Otherwise, you're linear growing, not exponentially growing.
Another strategy you've explained that really stuck with me is this idea of buying a newborn baby a rental property on a 15 or 18 year note, if you can get it, using that kind of as their college fund. Explain to us what the strategy is, how you came up with it, and how you've even used it.
Yeah, I mean, it was kind of an accident in a way. We were having Rosie, our first kid. Like, it's fun to pretend like this was like I'm just some super genius and I figured this out a long time ago. But no, I was having Rosie. We were having my first kid. And at the same time, we get this amazing fourplex under contract. And so as we're about ready to close on this project, we actually closed on it like the week she was born. We went and signed. It was Rosie's very first outing into the world, as we went to the title company and we signed papers for this fourplex. And then we fixed it up. And as we were doing that, and somewhere in that process, I think it was actually before I closed on it, I had the idea. I was like, well, what if I just paid this off over the next 20 years or 18 years while she's before she goes to college? And I'm like, well, it's worth a couple $100,000 today. It'll probably be worth at least $300,000 20 years from now. I mean, so if we bought a property and then just paid it off over the next 18 years, then that's a $300,000 profit we would have if we sold it or if we refinanced it that Rosie could use for college. And that's what started this idea. I was like, wow, like real estate's amazing for generating mass amounts of wealth over time fairly easily. Like think about the value, like how cool this is because we're not even talking about the property going like up in value that much. Like that's just a pretty like standard, like 3% per year, 2% per year growth. And in reality, the funny thing is I've now owned this property for 5 years. Rosie's five. It's actually worth closer to $400,000 today. 5 years in, not even 18 years down the road. We're talking 5 years in. It's already worth way more than I thought it was going to be worth down the road. But we're not talking cash flow. Like even though this property does cash flow about $1,000 a month and I get to keep that money, it goes in my pocket to let me live a cool life in Hawaii. But that property cash flows, but forget the cash flow. That property also gives me some amazing tax benefits. Forget the tax benefits. All that really matters is I'm paying off the loan over 18 years. So I literally just got a 30-year mortgage like everyone does. I went to Dave Ramsey's website and he has a like, if you prepay your mortgage a little bit every month, how fast can you pay it off calculator? I don't know what it's called, but it's called like the pay your mortgage faster calculator. Anyway, and I just figured out, I just kind of put in some numbers and figured out if I paid an extra $200 a month on my mortgage, it would take the mortgage from 30 years down to 18 years. And I'm like, well, okay, well, $200 a month is not that much. So I can shave off 12 years by doing that. But the real value in all of this, I mean, yes, I'm going to have a lot of equity. Yes, I get the cash flow. Yes, I get the tax benefits. Yeah, I get Rosie's college paid for. But the real value is that Rosie gets to see for the next 18 years and now like 13 years from here, she gets to see the value of real estate. As soon as she's old enough to do math, which she's getting close, she's in kindergarten now. So she starts doing math. Guess what? Who's going to be doing her profit loss statements every single month? Her and dad are going to be sitting down. And when she's old enough to be able to talk to the property manager on the phone, she'll be talking to the property manager about the issues that come up. So she's going to learn the power of real estate and the power of buying assets and not liabilities and the power of accounting and financial statements and all that. So that's the real value here as a real life example. And then of course I don't get to burden her with student loan debt. She's not going to be burdened with student loan debt. She can use that money for student loans or, you know, for college, or she can use it to go and start her own real estate journey or live off the cash flow and have her some money to get started with her career, whatever she ends up doing. So it's just a win-win-win-win-win across the board. I love that strategy.
It's kind of like a 529 plan, except you don't, with a 529 plan, you have to use it for college. I mean, you could take it out and pay taxes and all this other stuff, but with this, I mean, it's kind of like that. You still get tax benefits all along the way, like you said, but you don't have to use it for college.
Yeah. And I think the 529, I mean, it might be great. I'm not saying a person shouldn't do it, but no kid, I feel like no kid is going to get, like grasp, internalize this idea of my wealth is growing like you do when you own a piece of property. And every time we drive by that property, it's like, Rosie, that's your property. And so that's what I'm excited about with that strategy.
Let's take a quick break and hear from today's sponsors.
Hey everyone, it's Patrick, your host of Millennial Investing. Every year, my buddies and I do a guy's trip to escape the cold and dreary Ohio winters. Once we pick our destination, without fail, we all jump on Airbnb and find an incredible place to stay. We just got back from an amazing trip in Palm Springs, California, and our Airbnb home was a huge part of creating memories we'll never forget. I loved it so much, I'm taking my family back to Palm Springs for spring break, and we're staying in an Airbnb home my kids fell in love with and picked out themselves. While I was there, I had the realization that my own home could be an Airbnb. It's an excellent way to earn some extra cash, whether you're saving up for your next vacation, paying off some bills, or investing. Your home might be worth more than you think. Find out how much at airbnb.com/host. That's airbnb.com/host.
Today's show is sponsored by public.com. That's where you can earn 5.1% APY with a high-yield cash account. While we can't say for certain it's the highest interest rate out there, we can say this. It's a higher rate than Robinhood, a higher rate than SoFi, a higher rate than Marcus, a higher rate than Wealthfront, a higher rate than Betterment, frankly, a higher rate than Capital One, a higher rate than Ally, a higher rate than Barclays, a way higher rate than Bank of America and Chase, a higher rate than Citi, Wells Fargo, Discover, and it's a higher rate than American Express too. So, if you want to start earning 5.1% APY on your cash, check out public.com. We can't say it's the highest interest rate, but it's pretty damn up there. This is a paid endorsement for Public Investing, 5.1% in APY as of March 26, 2024, and is subject to change. A high-yield cash account is a secondary brokerage account with Public Investing, member of FINRA-SIPC. Funds from this account are automatically deposited into a partner bank where they can earn a variable interest and are eligible for FDIC insurance. Neither Public Investing nor any of its affiliates is a bank. U.S. only. Learn more at public.com/disclosures/high-yield-account.
Hey guys, when it comes to financial advice, you've got to trust the source. It's why you listen to this podcast. When I'm looking to upgrade my wallet, I turn to NerdWallet. Their expert team of nerds dives into the details to help you find smarter financial products. Before NerdWallet, I'd pay for vacations with whatever credit card was in my wallet. But I was missing out on miles I didn't even know I was leaving on the table. Now I've got a new card with more miles and more upgrades. What could future you do with more travel rewards? A hotel upgrade? Lounge access? A free flight to a bucket list destination? Wherever you go next, make it happen with a smarter travel credit card. Don't wait to make smart financial decisions. Compare and find smarter credit cards, savings accounts, and much more today at nerdwallet.com. NerdWallet, finance smarter. Check out nerdwallet.com and start making smarter financial decisions. As with all cards, credit is subject to lender approval and terms apply.
All right, back to the show.
I want to dive into your newest two-part series of books, but before we do, I have one more question, and it's very broad, and I know that, but it's a very common question that investors have, especially new investors, and it's something that you've done a lot. So what do you look for in real estate partners? What has made your partnership successful? And then what has made them, the ones that haven't been successful, what has made them unsuccessful?
Yeah, that's a great question. So let's talk about partnerships. So partnerships, I'm a huge fan of them. I love partnerships. I use them all the time. The right partner, of course. Now, I've had times where I've like, there's been people in my life where I'm like, hey, you're a cool person. Let's partner together. Those never work out. Those almost have never worked out, because just because they're a cool person or just because they have a pulse doesn't mean they're going to be a good partner. Like, so the first thing is thinking like, what do you need in a partner? If you're going to do a partner, like, what do you need? Do you need money? Well, good. You better hope that person has money. Do you need experience? They better have experience. So make a list of all the things that you need that partner to do. For many people, especially those listening to the show, it's probably you've got a lot of hustle. You've got a lot of knowledge and a lot of drive and motivation and excitement, but you don't have the capital. Great. So if you need a partner, maybe a partner who has some capital would be a really good idea. But now, just because they have money doesn't mean they're a good partner either. Like, they have to be the right personality fit. Yeah, I still like to, I like my partners. I don't want to work with anybody that I couldn't go grab a beer with after work, right? Like, I want to be with people I like. But my thought with partnerships, it's kind of like, I'll get biblical on you here, like Old Testament biblical. There's this guy, David, right? David and Goliath. Everyone's heard the story of David and Goliath. And David goes in the story to the king of like Israel and says, hey, I'm going to go fight that giant for you because all your people are too afraid to fight that giant. And the king says, oh, that's ridiculous. You can't do it. And he's like, no, seriously, I'm going to do it. And then the king's like, okay, go fight him. Why would the king let this kid who's like 12 go and fight a giant? It's pretty ridiculous to let a kid go fight some big, strong warrior, you know, like on the enemy, especially when the stakes were the loser loses the war. That was basically the gamble. It was like, whoever loses has to give up and they lose the war. Why would a king let a kid go and fight this giant? It's because David wasn't just a kid. He had actually said, I killed a bear recently and I killed a lion recently. In other words, he had proven himself to be a lion killer. And that's what I call my team oftentimes. We only work with lion killers. People have proven themselves already to be able to take down lions of their own before we bring them in. So how do we find those people? How do we know they're a lion killer? Well, resumes are generally crap. Like, people can write whatever they want. Like, oh, I'm a high achiever. Oh, I'm super dedicated. Oh, I work too hard. Whatever. Resumes, interviews are all crap. And so we run everyone through a gauntlet. Like, in other words, we throw a bunch of lions at them and see how they do to fight them. And if they come out the other side, they prove themselves worthy or, you know, capable, then we end up hiring them. A real life example of how we do that is we do a lot of internships. So we'll bring people on for a short term. For example, my finance manager today, Micah, who's awesome, he's brilliant. He started by just doing the books on one of my flips. He was like, hey, how can I provide value to you? And I was like, well, you're an accountant guy. Like, you can do accounting. So you're a financial analyst or whatever. Can you just do my books on this rental or on this one flip? He did a great job. He killed that lion. So we brought him in more heavily. Walker, my COO, he started out as an intern to help me find deals. And he ended up revamping our whole spreadsheet and ended up being really good talking to brokers. And he ended up working that way. Mike, my investor relations guy, he ended up just being basically killing a bunch of lions of his own and proving that he was like the most likable guy on the planet Earth. And so everybody that comes into our system, every partner that I have and every employee has to prove themselves. And my employees are generally all partners. Like, we all get equity. We're all proven lion killers. So that's the key with partners, is not just to hire someone just because they're there, but because they fit what you want, because they have a personality and a culture fit that you love, and they've proven themselves not just in their past, but also working with you. They prove themselves to be a lion killer. And that's when we'll commit full time to bringing them on.
So to dive into one of the strategies in your newest book, The Multifamily Millionaire, you talk about the stack and you explain how people can create $1 million net worth in just 5 years. And I think when people hear things like, oh, you could have $1 million net worth in just 5 years, it seems too good to be true. Kind of like one of those internet kind of foo-foo type things. I know it's a strategy. I know it's a real strategy. I know it works. I've read it. I understand it. I like it. I'm kind of working on it myself. So walk us through this strategy and explain to us how it all works.
Sure. It relates back to what I said a little earlier, and I'll repeat a little bit of it because it's so important. But it's this idea of like, if you grow exponentially versus linearly. So trying to build $1 million net worth in 5 years, that's pretty tough, right? If you buy a house for $100,000 and the next year you buy another house for $100,000, especially going to take you a long time. If you're saving up $100,000 to go buy a $100,000 house, that's going to take a long time. To take you 5 years just to save up for the first property, right? So the idea of growing fast is A, you have to use leverage, which means you're going to use a bank loan. You may even use no money down strategies. There's a lot of creative strategies with no and low money down, like raising money and partnerships where the partner brings the money and blah, blah, blah. There's a lot of strategies. So if people listening to this going, well, I can't do that. I don't have enough money with what I'm about to say. Just understand that there are dozens of strategies out there for investing with no and low money down. I even wrote a whole book called The Book on Investing in Real Estate with No and Low Money Down. So it's doable. So I just want to say that so you don't shut your brain off, everyone listening going, well, I can't do that. The idea of the stack is you start with, let's say, a duplex, like two units. And then later, maybe a year later, let's just say for easy math, you buy a fourplex. And then a year later, you buy an 8-unit. And then a year later, you buy a 16-unit. And then a year later, you buy a 32-unit. So at that point, you've got 32 plus 16 is what? 48 plus 8 is 56 is 60. So you got 62 units in 5 years. Now, each of those properties, you really only bought one deal per year for 5 years. That's all you bought. One deal per year for 5 years. That's not a lot of work. I mean, and again, people are saying, what about the money? Again, there's ways to overcome that. But if every one of those units, first of all, is giving you, let's say, $200 in cash flow, if every unit was netting you profit of $200 a month, you're now making over 12, what is that? 62 times 10, I mean, 100 would be 6,200. So over 12,000, $12,400 a month. You're making $150,000 a year in cash flow and passive income by owning this portfolio. And each one of these has equity, which means it's worth way more than what you paid for it. And so at the end of 5 years, not only are you making six figures in passive income, you've also got potentially $1 million net worth that you've built by doing this. And it's totally doable. In fact, true story. So I bought a property 2 years ago, that it was a mobile home park, and I had run my numbers so that in 10 years, it was going to be worth, we bought it, it was a set of mobile home parks. We bought it for roughly $6 million. And I said that with 10 years from now, it should be worth $10 million. Here we are 2 years later, and it's worth 13, maybe 14. And so we built massive amounts of equity. And in fact, I'm selling that property right now. And I should personally clear, personally, by myself, not even my team, like my take home is going to be over $1 million on one deal. Now, can you do that your first deal? No, you're not going to do that with your first deal. That's where you start with the duplex and then move up. But this was one of the first mobile home parks that I bought. And I used other people's money to buy it. And I'm still going to walk with $1 million. So that's how it's doable, is by getting outside your comfort zone, investing exponentially, and getting into those multifamily deals, which is where you can really scale up quick.
When people think about multifamily properties, specifically small multifamily real estate, they typically probably think of duplexes, triplexes, things like that. But in your book, you explain that there are seven different types of small multifamily real estate. Break down or explain to us what the seven are, and then which ones make for the best rental properties.
Ooh, all right, let's see if I can get them all. And there probably actually are more than this. This was just as I was writing the book. I'm like, what are the types that I see over and over and over? So let me see if I can get them all. First of all, there's a side-by-side. I love side-by-side, like duplexes, triplex, fourplex. It basically means like they're right next to each other, but they're not stacked on top. That's the next one, which is like the top-bottom or the up-down, or they have different names for that one. And then there's like the, let me see. We got one, we got the up-down. We've got the garden-style apartment. I'm skipping ahead a little bit. We have the garden-style apartment, which are typically like kind of the suburban-style apartment buildings, or those things. There's high rises, there's mid rises. There's something that I call, originally I'd called it the boarding house, but then I kind of changed it to like the starter apartment. It's usually like a 6, 7, 8 unit property, usually like a big long hallway down the middle, usually built in the early 1900s. There's a lot of those in big in cities. We have like, yeah, anywhere between 2 and 10 units crammed into like one building. You have the, what's called the monster house. The monster house is a freak of nature. It's a house that has been turned into a multifamily through a bunch of like additions and remodeling, and sometimes it's not done very well, and it's usually pretty ugly. But they can make a lot of money. Just got something to be aware of. Are they legal or are they not legal? That's a big thing I talk about in the book. But monster houses can be effective. So there's the side-by-side, the up and down, the monster house. I know I'm missing some in there. The starter apartment, the garden apartment, the mid-rise, high-rise. Yeah, There's a bunch of them. But just knowing what you're getting into, this is why it's important. People might be saying, well, why is that important? Let me explain. So knowing like, oh, this is a monster house. There are things you're going to want to be aware of, like the legality. Can you even operate this? Are they going to force you to turn it back? I bought a monster house a couple years ago here in Maui, about a year and a half ago. And the city found out it was a monster house. They found out it wasn't zoned for three units. And they are forcing me to turn it back into a single family house right now. It sucks. I did this big, huge rehab. And now I got to go rehab it again to turn it back into a single family house. Now, there's ways like I'm going to survive it. Like, for example, I'm going to basically rent by the bedroom. I'm just turning it into a rent by the bedroom kind of a situation. And so I'll get about the same amount of rent maybe. But that's something to know going into it is this going to be a legal property or not? Or let's say you have an up and down unit. The up and down stuff, they're fine. They can make a lot of money if you have like a, you know, like these are really popular, especially on the East Coast, but you have like three floors and each floor is a separate unit. Just know that you're going to get people who are like walking on the floor and the person below gets really irritated. So just know that, like, check out the sound quality. How thin are those floors? Or like, what does the water line do? You know, if it's an like up, down, top, bottom, like where there's like stacked on top of each other, those can be difficult to separate the water meters, which means you as a landlord are likely going to have to pay the full water bill. The electricity might even be combined on a monster house or on an up, down. So those are just things to be aware of versus a side by side, which you can usually separate the water meters because there's nobody on top of each other. So you're not mixing water lines quite as much. Just knowing what you're getting into can be a big help when you're looking into the multifamily space because it gets overwhelming. So you can just say, oh, I'm only going to look for a side-by-side right now. Let's go look for a side-by-side duplex, triplex, or fourplex. Nice and easy, gives me a lot of opportunity, and people like to live in those things.
Yeah, that was exactly what I did. So when I'm on my third house hack, and this one, I knew I wanted to buy a 2-4 unit, but I did not want to live up down for all of the reasons you mentioned. I only wanted side by side. So I offered, first property I offered on was a triplex, but it was three units side by side. Unfortunately, didn't get that one. Now what I live in today is a duplex, but it's side by side. We're not up down.
Yeah, I love that idea because it just, people tend to like those better. Less problem with tenants. Sometimes if you get the right one, I love the duplexes where there's garages that join in the middle. So it's like unit, garage, garage, unit. So like you're separated by two garages in the middle, which means you don't even hear the neighbor ever. And they typically have their own yard, front and back, their own driveway, which means you as a landlord don't have to do the landscaping because they each have their own garage. They can put their own lawnmower in it, their own snowblower if you're in a cold area. So you can take care of, like, the tenant pays their own expenses for that stuff. And if you can shift the water and electricity bill onto the tenant, your expenses just drop to almost nothing. So that's why I love those properties.
There's a bunch more strategies in the book. And if anybody wants to cover all of the strategies, go check out the book. But one more I want to talk about here today is how that we can quickly and accurately analyze a multifamily investment property. And you say it's regardless if it's two units or 20. So how do we do that quickly and accurately?
Yeah, good question. So I like to rely on something called the four square method. Now, this works really well until you get into like the 20, 30 unit range. Once you start syndicating and like you're raising money from people, you're going to want to get a little bit fancier on your paperwork here. But for most people, smaller to mid-sized multifamily, I call it the four square method. It's very simple. Just take out a piece of paper, make a big box, and then put a cross in the middle. So you basically have four little squares, four boxes. Now, in the upper left-hand box, right at the top, right, income. On the bottom left-hand box, at the top of the bottom left-hand square, right, expenses. On the top right hand corner, you're going to want to write cash flow. And on the bottom right hand side, you're going to write, income, expenses, cash flow. And I'm going to write, I think we're going to change this. Hold on. I'm going to put cash flow, I think, on the bottom right. I think that's what I have in the book. I've altered this slowly over the years. Go income, expenses. No, that was right. Cash flow on the upper top right. And we're going to go ROI. That's what I now have. ROI on the bottom right. That's what I got. Okay. So income, expenses, cash flow, top right. Bottom right is going to write ROI, or return on investment. And here's how we're going to do this. On the upper left-hand corner in that box that's labeled income, you're going to write down in a list all of your sources of income. So all your rents combined, stack them on top of each other and write all your income sources, including things like laundry income. If you got storage there, you can add the storage income, whatever. Then on the bottom left corner, you got expenses. You're going to list all your expenses. This is the key. This is the thing people screw up on. This is where you win or lose, is in this box of expenses. So you're simply going to list all of the expenses. Now, the key here is not just listing the taxes, the insurance, the mortgage payment, even though you should put all that there. The key here is knowing what expenses you need to account for over time. I'm going to explain what that means here. This is a super important concept. The phrase I like to say is phantom cash flow, and then there is pure cash flow. Now, there is fool's cash flow, I might even call it, because there's fool's cash flow, like there's fool's gold, and then there's real gold or pure gold. pure gold. Gold that's been purified has been put through the fire. It's been purified through fire or through like acid or whatever they purify gold with nowadays. But it's gone through some hell to get there. That's what we want to do with expenses. We want to write down all the expenses that could happen on average per month. And so specifically, there's like four things we want to include in this. Repairs and maintenance. That's one thing. Repairs. There's something called capital expenditures, which is like saving up money to replace your fridge, replace your water heater, replace your carpet, things like it's like replacements. So you're saving up money for that. So you have repairs, CapEx, property management that costs you every month if you're going to hire a property manager. And then you're going to have a vacancy, which means your property sits empty once in a while. Now add on to those four, all the other things, taxes, insurance, do you have an HOA payment every month? And you can work with an agent to really nail down these expenses. So add up all your expenses. So let's just say your income came to $10,000 every single month. Now you're on the expenses box and you add it all up and your expenses come to $7,000 every single month. Well, now on the third box, the upper right corner, all we're going to do is take income minus expenses, $10,000 minus $7,000. And remember that $7,000 number, that expense number is the pure cash flow after we're including taking out money for repairs and maintenance and vacancy and CapEx and all that. So we're left with, call it $3,000 in pure cash flow. And now the question is that a good deal or not? Well, that's what the final box is. ROI is your cash on cash return on investment. Take that total number, so $3,000 a month in this case, make it an annual number. So multiply by 12, we have $36,000. And then divide that by how much money you invested in the deal. So in that case, let's say we made $36,000 a year in cash flow and we spent $200,000 in our own cash. That's money out of our pocket for the down payment, for repairs, for whatever we spent. The total amount of money we spent was $200,000. Well, what's $36,000 divided by $200,000? 18%. 18%. That would be an 18% return on investment. Now that 18 is really good. I mean, I think anything over 10 is usually pretty darn good. If you can get over 10, if you can get 12, 15, that's phenomenal. 18 would be a home run.
And so where do people really, is that phantom cost? Is that where people really miss it?
Yeah, I think it's in the phantom cost. I think it's in those, the repairs, maintenance, vacancy. I think they forget to account for those things, especially CapEx and repairs. For example, CapEx, like it only happens, a refrigerator only needs to be replaced once every 5 or 10 years. But it's still like, I mean, think of it this way. A refrigerator costs $1,000 to replace. If you had to replace one every 10 years, that means you should be setting aside $100 every single year for that refrigerator. That means you should be setting aside about $8 every month for that fridge. And the same thing is true for the water heater, and the roof has to be replaced every 20 years. That's what kills most people's cash flow, is the capital expenditures, the repairs, and the vacancy, is people forget to account for that. And so if you account for it and the numbers look good, then fine. You're going to do great.
Before we wrap up the show and hand off to where people can find you, I like to turn the tables and let the guest ask me a question. So, Brandon, what question do you have for me?
Here's what I knew. How did you get into real estate?
I got into real estate by an accidental house hack. So, similar to you, my parents told me when I graduate college, I'm going to have to start paying him rent. My dad said, when you're going to earn a decent salary, you're going to have to start paying me rent. I said, okay, that's pretty fair, reasonable, but I just don't want to do it. And so I said, by the time I graduate college, I'm going to buy my first house. And everybody thought I was crazy. Nobody in my family ever invested. I was the first one in my family to go to college, all of that. And I was purely buying it simply just so I didn't have to pay him rent. I just didn't want to do that. I figured I'll just buy something. So I did. And ultimately, it was a 2-bedroom condo. I lived in it for a couple months and I realized I didn't even open the bedroom door for the second unit. And I said, I should probably do something with this. I hadn't heard of Bigger Pockets or real estate investing really at all. Ultimately, ended up renting out that one bedroom for like $700 or $750. And it only cost me like $1,000 or $1,100 all in with all expenses. And so I was like, wow, this is pretty cool. And I realized I'm not that smart. So somebody must have thought of this before me. Ended up searching it, of course, found you, Bigger Pockets, house hacking. That broke every limiting belief I had about real estate. And the rest is history.
I love it, man. Do you regret it?
Not at all.
Does anybody ever regret getting into real estate? It's like workouts. Nobody regrets doing a workout.
Yeah, it goes back to that same idea, right? You buy one and you never stop at one.
Yep, that's what it is, man.
Awesome. Well, Brandon, I've really enjoyed the conversation. I know the audience is going to enjoy it as well. You're all over the place, so I don't think people will have a hard time finding you, but where's the best place to go find you?
Yeah, good question. You know, I'm like a 13-year-old girl. It's like Instagram is like my thing right now. I got to change that story though. It's like 13-year-old girls are all on like TikTok now, but I'm also TikTok. But yeah, Beardy Brandon, beard with a Y, beard with a Y everywhere.
I'll be sure to put a link to Brandon's Instagram below, and you can also check through my followers and you'll see I'm following Brandon there. Brandon, thanks so much for joining me.
Hi, thank you for having me. It's been fun.
All right, guys, that's all I had for this week's episode of Real Estate Investing. I'll see you again next week.
Thank you for listening to TIP. Make sure to subscribe to We Study Billionaires by the Investors Podcast Network. Every Wednesday, we teach you about Bitcoin, and every Saturday, we study billionaires and the financial markets. To access our show notes, transcripts, or courses, go to theinvestorspodcast.com. This show is for entertainment purposes only. Before making any decision, consult a professional. This show is copyrighted by the Investors Podcast Network. Written permission must be granted before syndication or rebroadcasting.